What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Before we get into the grit of today, which is Palestine Post, I'm going to take just a minute and say happy birthday to my baby girl, who will not be happy that I'm doing this on the air, but I'm doing it anyway because it's a point of privilege. It's her mother. Happy birthday, Jaden. She's not a baby anymore. And then, because it's just the way my psyche works, in celebrating another year of my daughter's birth, I could not help, as I was preparing for this interview, to sit with all of the mothers in Gaza whose children will not see another birthday. The tens of thousands of mothers in Gaza who have held their dead babies in their arms, and our U.S. complicity in the murder of tens of thousands of children. That alone should have been enough for this government to say enough. It has not. It has been 744 days since October 7th, 2023. In today's casualties update, with American support, Israel has murdered 68,216 Palestinians and injured 170,361 more, most of them women and children. Since dawn today in Palestine, at the time of preparation for this episode, the IDF has murdered 57 people. The total people murdered by Israel since the supposed ceasefire is 97. An additional 230 have been wounded. We know from researchers outside of the Palestinian Health Ministry, like those at The Lancet, the death toll is closer to 80,000. And I actually saw something today that said closer to 500,000. I can't verify that yet, but I will get on that before next week. And that 80,000 is likely an undercount. Here on Law and Disorder, we've spent the majority of the Mondays of the last 2+ years, y'all, bringing you Palestine Post, where we push back on the Israeli and U.S. mainstream media campaign of disinformation as they continue to attempt to justify a genocide in order to maintain the status quo. We begin our hour with Curry Peterson-Smith, Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he researches U.S. empire, borders, and migration. Good morning, Curry.
Morning, Kat.
I mean, if something or someone can make me smile on Monday mornings, it is you, my friend. Let's start with the status of the ceasefire, Curry.
Yeah.
The Gaza government media office says that Israel has broken the terms of the ceasefire at least 80 times. Israel, of course, says it's only doing that because it's responding to Hamas breaking the ceasefire. Curry, it's been 10 days, my G. 10. That's it. 10 days. And out of that 10, correct me if I'm wrong, has there been a single day where Israel has not murdered a Palestinian?
That's a great question. And to my knowledge, the answer is no, there has not been a day when Israel hasn't murdered a Palestinian. I mean, this is, yeah, I mean, truthfully, like, murdering Palestinians is the daily business of the Israeli state, you know, murdering, torturing, abusing. And obviously that has been kicked into hyperdrive, you know, in the context of this genocide, but it's one reason why it's so challenging to just kind of turn it off, you know. I mean, as long as the flow of weapons continues, and it does from this country, Israel will continue to murder Palestinians because that's what Israel does. So that said, this kind of state of the ceasefire, which it's hard to even call it that, you know, it's unsurprising. I mean, it's devastating, but unsurprising that Israel has violated it so many times. Unsurprising not only because of what I just said about how Israel treats Palestinians just as a matter of its daily business, but over these past 2 years, obviously there's been this horrific genocide in Gaza that Israel's carrying out. Israel's also carried out this open-ended offensive all across the Middle East. And so there are other ceasefires that it has violated. I mean, Israel said that they would have a ceasefire in Lebanon, and they violated, right?
It's on the list.
It's kind of old, so we'll get into that. But
yeah,
you know, that's just to say, you know, Israel is not a credible actor when it comes to, you know, entering a ceasefire agreement.
Curry, I was holding you in my thoughts last week because I was walking through the 20-point plan with last week's guests. And one of the questions that I that I asked them that was really born out of conversations that you and I have had was, even though, right, we all knew as soon as the 20-point plan came out and there was the supposed signing of this. I mean, already, right, the U.S. and Israel were making claims about Hamas agreeing to disarm. That's not happening. But what I said, Curry, was, right, I'm not Palestinian. I hope I try, right, daily to be an accomplice. But because I'm not Palestinian, it is not my job, my right, to dictate, right, how Palestinians respond to that moment, right, where there was an announcement that there was a ceasefire.
Right.
And what I saw from my Palestinian comrades, right, including my friend Linda Sarsour, who's that's sort of my North Star in terms of what I'm supposed to do, think, and how I move, right, there was this moment of, we'll get to breathe for a moment. And then as I was reading reports, right, and I thought Curry would agree with that. Curry would agree with, like, we just want the bombing to stop. I think that's the right assessment of where you were likely sitting. And then I was reading things, right, about how the Palestinian people on the ground were responding, which also was with that, we'll get to breathe. And folks are trying to get back to what the nothing that is left of their homes, but where their, right, where their villages, their neighborhoods were. And so I'm wondering about the emotional impact and the toll on there has been no breath. And what do we do with that, Curry?
You're talking about four Palestinians in Gaza?
Yeah, and right, just I think all of us that have been sort of like, all right, well, we thought maybe there'd be a breath. There's no breath.
Yeah.
Turn up time.
Yeah, I really appreciate that question. I'm gonna answer it this way, and it's kind of, you know, it starts with a heavy and I think sobering assessment, you know, that at least the assessment that I have, which is Israel, part of how Israel works is, I mean, look, all colonial states normalize unreal amounts of violence against populations that they colonize, and they just consider it normal. You know, we could talk endlessly about the ways that that's done in the U.S., but we just had a holiday that, you know, where I live and in my community, and, you know, legally in my city, where we call Indigenous Peoples Day, and the president of the country and a lot of the country is saying, no, that's not what this is about. You know, we actually want to normalize and celebrate the man who sparked, you know, 5 centuries of genocidal violence against Indigenous peoples. You know, that's one of just countless ways that this is what colonial states do. All right, what Israel in particular does, I think, is they pilot forms of violence that, in the moment where they launch them, are considered beyond the pale, are considered outside of the bounds of, you know, human rights in the international community. And they say, we're doing it anyway. They did that when they first started building an apartheid wall across the West Bank in the early 2000s. When they first started building that wall, people, states, you know, the UN officials said, you can't do that. You can't wall off, you know, your borders. You can't wall out Palestinians. That's outrageous. And Israel said, we're doing it anyway. And then what happened? Other states did it too. And now there are walls, there are barriers on every one of Israel's borders, actually, not just the West Bank, but with Lebanon, with Gaza, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they did that with this targeted assassination program, is what they called it, when they started assassinating Palestinians from the sky in the early 2000s also. And again, it was said, you can't do this. You can't take a helicopter gunship that acts as judge, jury, and executioner and just kill Palestinians. And Israel said, we're doing it. And then what happened? The U.S. introduced the drone war and started doing the same thing. And now that's just part of our world, right? I believe that what Israel is doing is trying to normalize genocide, this kind of violence. They're trying to say, this is just part of our world in the 21st century. If we decide to cordon off a section of the planet and just target the vulnerable people within that, target their hospitals, et cetera, that's our prerogative. And so Sorry, that steps back from the question that you asked, but I've been sitting with what does it mean for all of us to live in what they're trying to make an era of genocide, not just sort of, you know, bounded chapters of genocide, as horrific and unexcusable as that is. They want to make this just part of life in the 21st century, you know, for the people living it in Gaza and for those of us witnessing it. And what does that do to that? What does that do to folks in Gaza? What does that do to us? What does that do to the descendants of folks in Gaza? I mean, it's catastrophic. And that's why we can't accept it. You know, we have said, I think that what's been really heartening is that we all over the world have drawn the line and said, a lot of violence has been normalized. We're not going to let this one go. We're going to draw the line here. No, you cannot compete under your flag at our sporting events. No, you cannot, you know, expect weapons from our country. We're going to draw the line here. So it is that struggle about, will this be an era of genocide where this kind of thing just happens and we have to sort of live with it? Or will we say no at every turn?
And this is I feel like a mandated moment to bring in Sudan and bring in the Congo, right? There are genocides happening in multiple places. And, you know, say folks like me and you and a scattering of others, no one's talking about that. No one's talking about what's happening to Black folks.
That's right. And if I can say just a word on that real quick, you know, what Israel's doing to Palestinians in Gaza, they're doing in the light. We are seeing it in ways that we are not seeing what is happening in Sudan and the Congo. I'll add Haiti, you know. And what I think about is if Israel can get away with treating Palestinians this way in the light, what can the nefarious forces of the world get away with in the shadows, right? So that is why, you know, like, of course, we have to talk about and bring in, you know, all the connections with Sudan and the Congo and Haiti and everywhere, you know, around the world. And there is a connection, right? Like, if we stop it in Gaza, that is kind of stopping this machine. I mean, every state in the world, every nefarious actor in the world is watching Israel to see, will they get away with this? Because if they do, there are forces that are waiting for their vulnerable populations to go after them. And so stopping it here means having more of a chance everywhere. And on the contrary, if they get away with this in Gaza, all the vulnerable people of the world are more vulnerable.
Well, we better get it into our language and our dialogue. The Zionist media propaganda machine. I don't know if you have these up with you. Well, I know where you live, so kind of not. But there's this group of Zionists, and they have these pink billboards, and the most they're all disgusting. They say, you know what I'm talking about? There's disgusting signs that they put up. And I was driving yesterday somewhere, and I saw this sign, and it said something akin to condemning Israel in Gaza, but silent about Sudan. I wonder why. And I almost crashed my car. It might be one of the most flagrant, most like, for them, basically they were calling, right, those of us criticizing them and not Sudan as anti-Black. That had to be the most anti-Black thing I've seen in, I don't know, since Trump's last tweet, maybe, but you know my point.
No, it's incredible. It's cynical is what it is, you know. I mean,
you don't care about Black people. Let's talk about your beating of Chris Smalls and the fact that you're still holding the young Mandela brand brother, right? Like, stop right. It.
No, there's so much to say, including, you know, if Israel and its supporters are all of a sudden interested in the fate of Africans, I would love to talk to them about how African migrants are treated when they try to enter Israel.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
Right. But it's also like, look at the prominent who are the loudest voices supporting Israel in this country? I mean, Donald Trump. Like these are not friends of black people. I mean, the Anti-Defamation League, whose central to strategy is collaboration with law enforcement. I mean, like putting aside the many, you know, just egregious anti-Palestinian things, you know, that the ADL does, their whole strategy is working with the police. And it's so much that it actually caused a crisis in the ADL during the George Floyd, you know, the post-George Floyd and, you know, murder of Breonna Taylor uprisings, because the young staff in the ADL were like, wait a minute, hold on. Like, their heads were exploding because they were like, I thought we were a civil rights organization, but we work with the police and the police are anti-black. So that's who supports Israel, is anti-black forces. So it's totally cynical and manipulative for them to try to position themselves as in any way caring or bring any light or concern to folks in Sudan.
Where do I want to go next? I'm clocking time, Curry. I'm clocking time. Okay, I'm going to do one more ceasefire, and then we got to move on to the West Bank, and then we got to hit Lebanon, and we got to do it all in 16 minutes. We got this. So as I started our conversation, right, we were clear that Hamas was not going to disarm itself as mandated by Trump's plan. And then, like, in my head, I mean, I was like, oh, so then that's going to be the justification of, right, the bombing to continue. And more so, United States, even more active engagement, right? Because now you're messing with Trump's real estate.
Right.
Facts. I don't think people are really paying enough attention to that, right? Like, it's about to be Atlantic City in Gaza by the time this dude is done. So the latest egregious move by the Trump administration is that the State Department put out a statement saying that Hamas is planning an imminent attack against the people of Gaza. And if it does that, so CBS News, and if it does that, that is a violation of the ceasefire that will require swift and immediate action from the United States, because now apparently the United States cares about the folks in Gaza being attacked by somebody. For those of you who can't see, Curry is shaking his head almost violently. He'll give himself a headache, my dear. My head exploded. I was like, wow, y'all are nefarious for real, for real. Right. And there are people but the scariest part of that, Curry, is there are people in my family that will read that on CBS News. And my cousin, in particular, she will say, see, I told Kat when we were sitting at the family dinner that some people liked, you know, were terrorists and they liked. They're going to absorb that. And if the United States does do whatever it is that the Trump administration will do, they'll go, well, you know, we tried. This is right. Their fault. It's the brown people's fault.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, there's so many things to say about this, but I'll just say this. I have been thinking about how, in so many ways, the genocide in Gaza has been enabled by, I will say, our collective failure to stop the war on terror. So much in that whole era of post 9/11 wars, so much of what they are doing in Gaza, what Israel's doing in Gaza, the U.S. piloted in Iraq. And when the U.S. is talking about protecting civilians from their evil Islamist overlords, that is right out of the war on terror playbook. Why did the U.S. Mm-hmm. need to invade Afghanistan? Because to protect women from the Taliban, right? So these are, you know, when the folks who you're talking about will be fooled by that, right? Folks who have otherwise said, oh, wow, it is terrible what's happening to those babies in Gaza, who will say, but, yeah, you know, those terrorists, you know, have to be stopped. What the U.S. is doing is relying on these tropes of the Muslim male, quote-unquote, terrorist, the armed, you know, kind of figure, and it is a trope that the U.S. has held up for a long time, particularly over the course of the so-called war on terror. And unfortunately, we have not sufficiently dislodged that trope, you know, and so that's what they are playing on now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, Curry, we got to move to the West Bank, because I feel like the West Bank always sits left out of the conversation, and things have been really ramping up there. Local authorities said that more than 1,050 Palestinians have been murdered in the West Bank, around 10,300 wounded, over 20,000 arrested, including 1,600 children, since this iteration of the genocide in Gaza started 2 years ago. On Monday, Which is our Sunday, by the way. We're behind by almost a day, just so folks know what I'm saying. Days. The IDF bombed a school. Settlers brutally attacked civilians trying to harvest olives. Encampments are springing up everywhere. Israel continues to kick people out of their homes and declare areas as military training grounds. This is the largest annexation. That seems like such a mild word. I need another word. Land grab. That's what Chairman Fred Hampton Jr. would say. This is the largest land grab since the 1933 Oslo Accords. I'm going to read one more fact, and then I'm going to let you talk. A new report by the Colonization and Wall Resistance Commission said that the Israeli army seized 147 square meters of land under a, quote, military and security seizure order. What does, first of all, your reaction to that, and then segue into what does what's happening in the West Bank tell us about Israel's actual real and for real plans in Gaza? Because for me, from a strategic, I can't see... You can't be like, you're right, we're going to chill out here and allow them to rebuild and then continue to do what we do until their cousins, mothers, fathers, uncles, aunties in the West Bank, right? They're one and the same, no matter what division there are in actual borders. I put that in air quotes.
Right. Well, that and that's the kind of look that like Israel's justification for, you know, its violence in Gaza is Hamas, you know, is in control of Gaza. And so we have to defeat Hamas. We don't. We can't declare victory until Hamas is defeated. Well, Hamas is not in control of the West Bank. So, you know, how does that explain, you know, Israel's actions there? And I think that a more accurate frame is to say that Israel is now and has always, the project of Israel has always been about removing the Palestinian population, removing as many Palestinians as possible. That's how the state was founded. And then seizing as much land as possible, you know, and at times it has been incremental, like when they built that apartheid wall, and the various ways that Israeli settlers in Jerusalem and in the West Bank literally sit outside of the homes, like the actual houses of Palestinians, and wait for Palestinians to leave the house so that Israelis can run in and take the house. That is why Palestinians in the West Bank in Jerusalem, they never leave their houses vacant. You know, they always leave somebody home because they know that if the house is vacant, is if everybody's out, Israelis might seize their house. That is what happens every day. You know, that's what Israel does. And so they use different ways of displacing and terrorizing Palestinians. But the goal is always the same. Control as much land as possible, displace as many Palestinians as possible, and then have the remaining Palestinians under Israeli control and kind of be politically neutralized. They are piloting certain ways of doing that in Gaza, and then they are deploying them elsewhere in Palestine. And I will name two, you know, I think it's right to call attention to the West Bank. I will just name things have also been very difficult for Palestinian citizens of Israel within the so-called borders too. I mean, this is all across Palestine, right? But in Gaza, it's the most aggressive, and it's in the West Bank, it is also aggressive. And they are doing what they have done in Gaza with airstrikes, with drones, et cetera. They're now bringing it to the West Bank. So this is not about, you know, destroying Hamas, as they say. This is about seizing Palestine.
We should talk about the latter. I'm up next time you're on the show. What's happening inside of those walls to folks, because that also doesn't get talked about. Kurt, I've said this before, and it you know, I'm clearly not a law and order gal. Name of the show. Reflective of my sort of whole POV of the world, but part of the international community, including the United Nations, says Israeli settlements are legal. They're not legal on an international law. I mean, either it's genocide, but, you know, let's put that aside just for a second. The UN warns over and over again that the continued settlement expansion, right, has all of these negative consequences. I'm not, you know, including the viability of this two-state solution, which, I'm sorry, is gone. It's off the table. Bye-bye. But nobody does anything. Right, the international court and its warrants, the UN, like nobody, if I go outside and I do something that this country has deemed illegal, they're going to kick in my door, drag me out of my house and hold me accountable. And it could be anyone, one of the law enforcement, right? It could be OPD, it could be the sheriffs, it could be CHP, it could be the ATF, it could be the FBI, like it could be anybody, right? They don't care. Just go get her. But is everybody just scared of Israel? Like, for real, like, what's happening?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. I mean, and this this gets at, you know, there's two problems here. One is, you know, the United Nations and the kind of modern iteration of international law is constructed after World War II, right? And as you know, the San Francisco Bay Area had a role in that. There was a UN conference in San Francisco. You know, this is all after World War II, which happens to be the same exact time in history when the State of Israel is declaring itself and it's expelling Palestinians. So as the architecture of international law is being crafted in real time as it's happening, there is a Palestine exception being built into it, right? And so even as the UN kind of goes on, and as Palestinians and their allies in third world states use the UN and international law to do things like pass, you know, General Assembly resolutions and declare Israeli practices illegal, that actually translating into something plays out differently than other UN resolutions do that the US supports, right? The other problem is that there's a general question, which is who enforces international law? I mean, the Hague doesn't have, you know, an enforcement mechanism. I mean, the enforcement mechanism is supposed to be the states of the world, the UN member states are supposed to enforce it, but that's kind of their prerogative, you know, as we see. And so that's a problem. That is a limitation of one of the many limitations of international law. I do want to also, just to get at your question, is everybody just afraid of Israel? One of the things that I think that these 2 years have really revealed is that obviously Israel is leading this kind of ferocious colonization of Palestine. Obviously the United States is arming it to the teeth, but it's actually not just the United States that is invested in this. I am struck by how many states of the world are behind Israel. I am struck by, I know we're running low on time, but just to go back to before this particular chapter of genocide, there's something called the Abraham Accords. You know, this was an effort which was to get Arab states in the Middle East, North Africa, to normalize relations with Israel. And it was under the first Trump administration, and basically they said, We want deeper relationships with your Arab states. We want Israel to have relationships with your Arab states. And the problem has been this pesky Palestinian problem. You know, unfortunately, these Palestinians keep calling attention to the fact that they have been forcibly displaced from their own homes and denied the right to return to their homes. So what if we just took that off the table? Could we, if we did that, if we just put the Palestine question aside, can we go ahead and move forward and normalize relations? And the United Arab Emirates said, yes, we can. And Bahrain said, yes, we can. And Morocco said, you know, we're interested too. So there has been this desire for what they're calling the so-called new Middle East, where all these states, which have their own very messed up problems, you know, the UAE, Egypt, Jordan, you know, these are monarchies, right, and dictatorships whose governments do not care about Palestinians, even if their populations do. And they're trying to move forward, you know. And it's not just those states. It's the EU that's Israel's biggest trading partner. I mean, there's a deep investment in Israel that goes well beyond the United States. And that is what we're up against. That's why this thing has persisted so long.
Sorry, I want to talk about Lebanon, but I'm out of time. I'm going to bring you back again, of course. I do think it is where actually, I'm going to give you 60 seconds. The Israel just bombed Lebanon again. There's been a ceasefire since, I believe, November of 2024, I think, is what we're talking about.
Right.
Just in terms of the impact on Hezbollah, I mean, it's murdered most of its leaders. It continues to bomb, right, the general population, and which often can create agitation among the people, right, who are getting mixed information because the government of Lebanon is also like, yo, Hezbollah, you got to chill out. head exploding. So I just want to give you a second to respond to that real quick.
Yeah, and the quick response is that this is not about... This is about Israel dominating the Middle East, you know, full stop. That's what this is about. You know, and that's why, despite the so-called ceasefire, Israel continues to bomb Lebanon, right? As they continue to attack Gaza, as they continue to threaten Iran, et cetera. That's what it's about. And I will end on the point that all of that said, the people of the world are speaking up, you know, and while these states may be complicit and, you know, and Palestinians and Lebanese and Iranians folks are paying the price, people all around the world are saying, we're not going to accept this. And that is the only thing that is, you know, forcing any kind of restraint. You know, that is the only thing that is forcing the states who have said, okay, we are going to have an arms embargo. It is driven by that popular power and the popular movements. And so I know that folks are weary. I know that folks are hurting. I know that folks are devastated, and that is real, and we have to hold that. And the worst thing we could do would be to take our foot off the gas. We have to keep our foot on the gas and keep going.
Put on the gas, Curry. I'm racing down the road with you, my G. All right, I got to let you go. I'm going to talk to you soon.
Appreciate you.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.